I think the lesson I learned is age is not a barrier. I think, you know, I am, for just only riding a year after a huge break, I'm pretty flabbergasted at how fit I am. I thought it would take, you know, a lot longer, if, you know, never, to kind of get to my current, you know, fitness level. So that's encouraging. Like, you know, age, you know, just because you're 55 doesn't mean you can't go out and do cool rides. Like, it's not a limiting factor at all. Might not be quite as fast as you were when you were younger, but, you know, who cares about that? Just go out and have fun.
Hello again, friends, and welcome to My Back 40. In the My Back 40 podcast, I'm your host, Steve O'Shaughnessy. Well, I don't have any voice intros for you today, but that's okay. I'm patient. I want you to send me some. If you're sitting on the couch thinking about something, or you're out there on the trail and you want to reach out and say hello to the My Back 40 community, I'd appreciate it. Whip out your device, record me something, and send it to myback40podcast@gmail.com, and I'll put it at the start of the show. As you could tell maybe by that person's voice at the beginning, that's John Stamstad. We had another conversation. I know we just seems like we just spoke yesterday, but he rode the Cross Washington mountain bike route, the XWA, and he was trying to do that as quickly as possible. And he had a very interesting journey, and we're going to talk about that on today's podcast. So stay tuned. We'll get there shortly. You guys know, if you want to check out other podcasts that I have available for you, you can subscribe on your favorite listening platform, or you can head on over to mybag40.org and check out some of the episodes I have there. I've done a little bit of writing, but I don't have time to write. So there is kind of some words in there, and there's some great articles, little short pieces I've written in the past about some of the adventures I've been on. There's not a lot there. Like I said, I don't have time to just sit down and punch out stories. I wish I could. I love writing, and I don't really consider myself a wordsmith, but I think it's a great exercise. I've begun journaling a lot, trying to get my shit together, and I find it's a really interesting way. So, I mean, really, I journal with a mechanical pencil in a notebook, and it's so funny how I just don't do that. I don't write stuff. Everything's always being typed, whether with my, with our new, primary digits, our thumbs, or, on a keyboard. It seems like we're always in front of a screen typing something. So it's really a beautiful thing to sit down with a book and a pen or pencil and just kind of write down your thoughts. And I try to do that in the morning, and it helps clear my day for the rest of the day. And it's been quite effective. So, I don't know why I'm talking about that. I guess we were just talking about writing stuff, and I don't know, whatever. But, I want to talk to you a little bit also about the Misaka Cycling Club. They're doing a jersey fundraising event right now. And if you want to have one of those wicked orange Misaka Cycling Club jerseys, I want you to go over to the MisakaCyclingClub.com. And at the top menu, there's a jersey link, and you click that and you can buy one of their awesome jerseys. And the proceeds are going to go to building this club, a clubhouse in Uganda. Super important. There's a lot of amazing talent there, and they want to showcase it to the world. I spoke about it a little bit in some other podcasts, but you know, a little bit of money goes a long way, and maybe you don't have the money to buy a jersey, but there's a lot of other ways you can give. And let's give these kids a clubhouse. I'm reaching out to the community of listeners that I have, and if those of you have kind of not really been looking into it yet, please do go check it out and do what you can. I know times are tight, and it's crazy bananas right now, but even a one-time donation would really help them get this clubhouse off the ground and help those guys over there showcase their talents on the world stage. So yeah, just reach it, take some time, check it out. And I'd really appreciate it. I want to thank Rebound Cycle and Cycling 101 for their support of the podcast. Without you guys, I wouldn't be able to do this. And I want to thank all my supporters that have supported me recently. DC, thank you so much for your contribution to the My Back 40 podcast. I'd like to send you a t-shirt. I'm not sure if you're going to hear this. I emailed you, but please, if you want one, let me know what size you want, and I'll send it your way. It's the least I can do. If I had hoodies, which I like to have at some point, then I would send you a hoodie, but I don't have any. So I really do appreciate it. If you want to find out more how you can support the MyBike 40 project. The easiest way actually is just to go onto the listening platform that you enjoy and give me a 5-star rating and a review, or you can head on over to myback40.org/support and have a read, see what you think. And if you find value in the content and you want to kick in, I'd really appreciate it. It takes a lot of time and effort and resources to put a podcast together and get these awesome conversations to you. So anything you can do to help would be much appreciated. So today on the podcast, I bring you John Stamstad. I was able to talk with John on a previous podcast. Wasn't too long ago, and I was a bit worried about putting him out so quickly, but he attempted the Cross Washington Race, XWA, and he had an interesting journey, and I wanted to talk to him about that. I first met John at the Ride the Divide 10-year anniversary. He was on the panel, and I really kind of dug what he was putting down about just the meaning behind these big journeys and how important they are, just even from a mental health standpoint. And we talked a bit about that on our the podcast that we did on the MyBack 40 podcast, just a handful before this one. But yeah, I wanted to get him back on to talk about this crazy journey. He had to scratch his attempt. He had some major malfunctions, biological malfunctions. And we talk a lot about that, and we talk about the meaning behind the journeys, and we talk a little bit about nutrition as well. It's a great conversation. I always love connecting with him. And without further delay, here is John Stamstad. So how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good.
Awesome. Thanks for connecting with me again. I know we just spoke, but I think you did something that I think for you might have been fairly profound. So I wanted to talk to you about it.
Yeah, of course.
I remember when we last spoke, you had said you had been kind of curious about testing your limits again. And so did that all kind of come together just in the last, I guess, couple months since we last spoke? Or?
Well, I was planning on doing, you know, an event this year. I signed up for Dirty Kanza XL. So I was going to do that in whenever that end of May, and then that got postponed and then canceled. So then I looked at, you know, alternatives, and, you know, I live in Washington. So the Cross Washington Trail seemed, you know, logistically, you know, pretty, you know, efficient to do, because travel's been so, you know, mixed up this year. It's hard to plan anything, but I figured I could, you know, do that. And there was going to be so originally they were going to have their grand, you know, depart, you know, the unofficial underground race kind of thing in May. And they postponed that to the second weekend in September. So I was like, oh, you know, if I'm going to do it, I might as well do it with a, you know, group of like-minded folks, you know, that'd be fun. So planned to do that. And it was all set to go until like literally 2 days. It was like, it was going to start that weekend, and on Thursday, like the whole east side of Washington just blew up in flames and fires.
Oh yeah, of course.
And a lot of the land was shut down. So it was not a, you know, oh, it's just inconvenient or breathing smoke. It was like, it was no go. Like wasn't feasible. So I kind of waited and thought, well, if I can still have a weather window here in a few weeks, you know, I'll give it a shot before winter comes in. And I got that window. So I took off, whatever it was, October 4th, I think I left.
The smoke was crazy. Like up here in Canada, like we got away from smoke for the most part this year. We had a couple of fires close to us. But the smoke coming up from the south, like from Oregon and Washington, it was crazy. It was just so thick here. Was it clear when you left on your trip?
No. So we were getting some of that California fire smoke. So it was pretty smoky out on the Olympic Peninsula, but it didn't bother me. And then as soon as I got over the mountains, it was clear. Air was fine.
That's good, because that's such a detriment. Like trying to push yourself through dirty air like that. I remember doing a training ride a couple of years ago when the fires were really bad here, and it just destroyed me. You know, it just destroyed me. It was so suffocating to be riding through that stuff. So I'm glad it was clear for you. That's awesome.
Yeah, I've had issues with asthma, and it doesn't bother me unless there's particles in the air. either, you know, dust from the trail or smoke. So
that's good. Last thing you need is to not be able to breathe on an event like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, you take breathing for granted. Yeah, you want to take breathing for granted.
Yeah, and I think a lot of us take for granted the air quality. Like, you don't really consider it very, very often. And then when you see the fires, and then you go online and you look at some of the resources, the air quality resources, and you realize during a forest fire season, the air is, it's gnarly. Like, you really shouldn't be outside in it. Like, what is it? We had between eights and tens for about a week up here. And it's like, man, you shouldn't even be outside, really. You should be inside.
Yeah, here the measurement is AQI. And I think it was, you know, Seattle was around 300. And, you know, on a normal day, it's the AQI is maybe 20. You know, so that's they were listing it as, you know, hazardous, you know, to breathe. I'm not sure what that means. I did a long ride. I did an 18-hour ride when the AQI was in the high 200s. And it seemed like I was climbing a little bit slower when I was down low. And then when I was above the smoke, you know, I was climbing a little bit faster, you know, just looking at the, you know, a metric. But I didn't, in terms of perception, I didn't notice it. That doesn't mean it's not affecting you greatly, but it just, my breathing wasn't labored. You know, I wasn't having any, and afterwards I wasn't coughing for a couple of days, which sometimes happens, you know, when you're breathing dust, you just get that hacker's cough.
Yeah, for sure. So for people who aren't familiar with the Cross Washington, why don't you just tell us a little bit about the route?
So the Cross Washington Trail, sometimes known as the XWA, put together by Troy Hopwood, who did a fantastic job of organizing and promoting that trail. It goes from the coast on the Olympic Peninsula to the Idaho border, you know, just over by Spokane, and is, depending on the route, around 680 miles long and has about 50,000 feet of climbing. So it's, you know, it gets up to about 6,000 feet maximum, which for Washington is pretty high. And it's just, it's spectacular terrain. You go from rainforest to, you know, alpine to high desert.
So the terrain's quite varied, obviously, from coastal to desert. And were you doing any training up to this point? Or just kind of just getting out and riding your bike, or?
Yeah, I trained pretty good. I was well prepared for it, I think.
And what were
you? I mean, I hadn't ridden my bike in much at all in almost 20 years. I hadn't done an event in 20 years. I did some running. I did some ultra running in the early 2000s. But then from 2010 on, you know, I kind of did the sit on the couch and get fat thing. A little over a year ago, I weighed 180 pounds and then started riding my bike last summer. And, you know, I'm at my, you know, kind of prime weight of mid 130s.
Nice. That's a lot of weight. We've never met, so I'm not sure of your stature, like how tall you are, but still, like, that's like 50 pounds. That's a lot of weight to be. You don't realize, like, even if you lose 10 pounds, go and grab a 10 pound weight and lift that up, and you're carrying that shit around. And it's amazing how, especially if, I don't know what kind of experience you've had, but my weight can fluctuate quite rapidly. In fact, since I've changed the way I eat, it seems to be way more stable. But you don't realize you'll go into spring after a winter of kind of ignoring your diet, and you go in 10 or 20 pounds heavier and you're climbing the same hills. And this is after fat biking all winter, so your fitness is still pretty good. And then you go climb into the mountains and you're carrying like 10 or 20 extra pounds. That's so much weight. You don't realize how much it is.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, well, that's good. That sounds like you're in your good climbing weight to go do 50,000 feet of climbing.
For sure.
That's awesome. So now you had your experience was challenging, I'm to understand, by reading a few of your posts. I'm not sure if you did a write-up yet. I hadn't seen it pop up.
I haven't. I'm working on that. I'll put that up in the next couple of days. Well, so I didn't know what to expect. you know, when you haven't done, you know, a long ride in, you know, 20 years, like kind of anything can happen. I mean, you know, in some ways mentally I'm the same as I was, you know, back in the day, but you know, I'm 55 years old now. So one, just purely age, you know, has to affect a lot. And then, you know, not doing a sport for 10 years or any sport for 10 years, you know, that has an effect too. So I had very low, I would say I had very low expectations. You know, I thought I could finish the ride. You know, I didn't think I'd do it very, you know, fast. I thought I'd, you know, really feel, you know, the years on my system. But as it turns out, I went out pretty slow, but I've never felt better. And I rode, I kind of wanted to just see, you know, how I was doing. So I thought, you know, I think I'm going to skip sleeping the first night and see how I do with that, see if it's a struggle. And then, you know, I'll probably sleep the second night and then maybe go the rest of the way to the finish if, you know, my system is working. And I was super surprised. Like the first night, I don't think I could have slept. You know, I was pretty, you know, amped and, you know, going well. I never forced myself. You know, if I'd gotten super tired, I just would have stopped. Like there was no rush. You know, nothing was pushing me. But I just felt so good. I kept going. And so that was nice to feel. And then the second night, you know, I stopped mainly because, you know, there was some hard terrain ahead and I thought it'd be better to be conservative, but I could have ridden through the second night. You know, I hadn't taken any caffeine. And I guess, so I stopped around midnight. I slept for a little over 4 hours and then got, you know, going again and felt great when I woke up. You know, the rest, you know, did me well, but didn't think it wasn't critical. I wasn't, you know, like just, I mean, sometimes you're just doing the slog. You're just trying to keep moving, you know, to stay awake. And I didn't have any of that. But then that next day, up when I got high on the east side, it got, I mean, somewhat hot. It wasn't really hot. It was like 80, which is warm for around here. But I sodium depleted. And I even felt it kind of coming on. I had picked up some jerky, which I thought I would do, you know, just for some differentiation, you know, in my food. Jerky doesn't have a whole lot of calories. It's actually, you know, it's more protein. It's not high fat. But I picked it up knowing it's got a lot of sodium, and there are some good reasons to, you know, try it. And the old Polar Explorers, that's what, you know, they fueled on. So there's kind of a connection there that's, you know, somewhat fun. And I noticed when I chewed on the jerky, my speed increased noticeably. I thought, well, I can't be getting that from the calories. It's not like I'm bonking, you know, and I'm getting, you know, caloric energy. It's got to be the sodium. So I started, you know, trying to increase my sodium intake. But then I totally crashed. And I mean, I ground to a halt. And I was 300 yards from the top of the last climb going into Wenatchee. So all I had to do was make it 300 or 400 yards. And then it was a 10-mile, mostly paved, you know, descent, like super easy. The hard descent was over. This was just the last, you know, little bit. And I couldn't do it. I had to sit down on the ground. And, you know, at first I thought, well, maybe I'm bonked. So I tried, you know, eating, because it kind of felt that way. It felt like I had no energy. Well, I started eating and then felt that, you know, bad stomach feeling coming on where, you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to start throwing up. And so I did. I couldn't keep anything down. Wow. Couldn't even keep down water. And I'm just thinking, like, I'm just trying to get three. And then also I had no, like, I was in a cell service hole. So I'd like told a, I'd called or texted a friend of mine in Wenatchee and we were just going to meet for a quick dinner, you know, as I rolled through town and, you know, say hello. And then I was going to be on my way. So he was waiting for me because I said, oh, I'm on the last descent. You know, I'll see you in just a little bit. And then I couldn't, you know, even get this 300 yards. So I sat and I'm like, God, I'm going to have to bivvy here. Like, I don't think, But then I thought, I'm pretty sure it's sodium. And I had some sodium concentrate with me. And so I started mixing it, you know, really thick, like 1,000 milligrams in, 4 ounces of water. And it just tasted like sugar, you know. And I trust my, the way I connect with my body. If something tastes good, it usually means it's, I want it. And so that went down super well and it stayed down. So then I just kept trying to, not rush it, but, get that back into my system. And, finally I was able to, I made it a little bit further up and, but then still thought, I needed to bivy. So I slept for a couple of hours and then woke up and, it had absorbed into my system and I started feeling better. So I'm like, oh, all right, I can. Oh, well, the other reason I moved was the bivy spots were terrible. It was like the worst, scrappy desert, like bad sand and, thorny bushes. And I started getting ants crawling all over me.
Oh, no.
So I'm in my sleeping bag and I've got ants going up my leg. And I'm like, this is not going to work. Like, no. I'm not going to sleep like this. So I packed up everything, which was, not the easiest thing to do because I was in a bad state, but I was like, all right, I'll descend into Wenatchee and, probably spend the night there, figure things out. And had no, at that point, I thought my ride for sure was over. Like I couldn't crawl, for a bit there. So figured I was completely toast, but needed to get to civilization. But then got to town, slept, felt significantly better the next morning. So I thought, well, I'm feeling good. So I think I'll give this a try and keep going because, who wants to, quit? But the next section was much more deserty and hot and much more exposed. So I was really nervous about that. Because once you've, the other danger of once you've run into sodium problems, and I hadn't been dehydrated at all, like my, I kept a very good eye on that and I was not dehydrated. So that's why I, was pretty certain I was sodium, deficient. But the problem comes in when you start loading sodium is you can go the other direction. And so and it has some of the same symptoms. I mean, it can really mess you up. I'm trying to do the math on figuring out, all right, how much sodium did I have? Is that too much? Like, how much can the body hold? And so you start driving yourself kind of crazy when you're playing. Like, that's not a game you want to be in, especially heading out into the, hot desert. But I threaded that needle and I made it through that next day just barely. I had to stop around 4 o'clock. I had to stop because I felt like, those heat stroke symptoms, kind of coming on. I sat down and I ate 4, sticks of jerky and each one of them had 500 milligrams of sodium. And then I drank another 1500 milligrams. And then, so I got into the next town, felt good and started out, like slept for a few hours, headed out the next morning. And then that next day I made it to noon and then I felt it coming on again. And the next section that I was on was, again, like high desert and there was no shade. Like there was no, the day before there was at least, there was a lot of geography, some mountains. So I could get behind the shadow of a mountain for a lot of it. And that really helped me. But then the last 150 miles to the finish was, all sun and no shade. And I just thought, that's pretty risky. So I turned around and went back to this really crappy little town of Warden. And I thought I'd sit there the afternoon and just kind of ponder, what I should do next. I sat there and I didn't really feel much better. And I just thought, it might be better for my health if I just pack it in and, wait for another day rather than, play games with heat stroke with nowhere to, it's one thing if, if I can hide in the shade, if I get too hot or too low in sodium, I don't mind sitting in the shade for a while and recouping, but when there's no shade, like things can go downhill pretty fast. Mm. And I just thought that was, the risks outweighed the rewards at that point. And so I thought I'd, you know, cut my attempt early. So I made it 550 miles, you know, out of the almost 700, which is disappointing. I don't drop out of many events, you know, in my, you know, career, but sometimes you have to be super honest with yourself and listen to your body. And sometimes that answer is no, today is not the day. Like, wait for another time. You know, don't be, you know, there's no glory in being stupid, you know, at a certain point. Everybody wants, you know, you want to be tough and, you know, you don't want to be a quitter, but, you know, there's also the line that you cross where you're just being dumb. And I felt like I was at that dumb line.
I think given your history, no one thinks that you're a quitter or weak by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, we can obviously appreciate, you know, having that time off the bike. It's funny because it's, for people who haven't done a big event, it's, you're constantly within your body. You're constantly thinking about how you're feeling, how's your energy, you know, sleep, fatigue, balance, cramping, calories. You know, it's not just two sides of a scale. There's like eight sides to the scale. And mm-hmm. It seems like you're constantly always trying to balance, like nutrients, yeah, sleep, energy output, et cetera, et cetera. just to go back a little bit, explain to people what it feels like to be, in your experience, to be sodium depleted.
Well, I think I was trying to think back. It's never happened to me, you know, to that extent, you know, I think I always have had not a sodium problem, but I think I burn more sodium than some, even though like all of my best races have been in, you know, severe heat. You know, I once ran the White Rim Trail unsupported. So pushing a baby jogger, you know, full of water in 105 degree temps, you know, biked across the outback of Australia. So, you know, I kind of seek out, you know, the heat and have, you know, done pretty well in it. And at least in my younger self, the warning signs that I see come on when I'm having sodium issues is I start to have digestion problems. And I think if and digestion problems are super common for people any ultra sports, but especially ultra running because you're bouncing up and down, or mountain biking because you're, you know, jostling yourself too much and it's hard to digest. And people usually blame whatever it is that they're eating. And I just don't think that's true. I think it's, you're almost like you're low on some electrolyte and it's usually sodium because that really, has an impact on your digestion. And so if I was in an event and I start to like gag on food or, you know, things just aren't going down the way that they were, I start increasing that sodium before you hit the point where you can't keep any food down. And you're throwing up, which I have in 24-hour races. Like, I'm not sure I've ever done a 24-hour race where I haven't thrown up, you know, at least a couple of times. I mean, that's kind of the normal. You know, it's hard to take in that many calories and have your blood, you know, go to your legs also. Like, they're competing for blood supply. So it's always a game that you play. But so, like, you know, when I, you know, hit this depletion point, I'm going up this climb and I knew that I was really pushing it in terms of like, boy, I'm not doing well here. And I remember thinking like, I wonder what happens when you get to the point where you're pushing it too far and you're doing too much. And about 10 seconds after that, I just collapsed. I mean, I just, you know, I didn't cry. I just fell off my bike and I was like, oh, well, that's what happens. Like, you kind of, I didn't pass out, but I just got kind of dizzy and, you know, just lost my balance and fell over. So that's what happens. And then I sat there trying to figure out, you know, what happened. And then, like I said, I tried loading food. And because that wasn't the answer, my body rejected it and I started throwing up. So I was throwing up everything including, you know, plain water, because then you think, well, maybe I'm dehydrated. You go through, you know, the mental list and start trying things. And then, you know, I, you know, went through rationale and decided, oh, you know, it's got to be sodium. So then the sodium went down super well, like tasted good, you know, stayed in my stomach, you know, processed through my system. But then still, like, I couldn't, I've been, you know, crashed and, you know, I've bonked like everybody has. I've been tired. I've been exhausted. But I'd say this is the first time where, I mean, I couldn't have crawled. Like, I was, you know, not just totally in the fetal position, but I was close, where I was like, I need to lay down. I can't move for a while. And it took me, I think it took me 3 hours to go 300 yards. And I was trying. Like, I thought, you know, I need to get there. I need to get to the top of this. I'll feel better mentally. You know, I can get some connection. And I couldn't do it. Like, I was stuck there. It wouldn't have mattered where I was. And I wasn't in a, you know, hospitable, you know, immediate environment. And I felt extremely powerless. Mm. It's the most powerless, you know, I've ever felt. I was not in control of, you know, the situation.
Yeah, your body tends to control the situation, right? It's like, no.
Yeah.
You need to stop. You need to stop moving because I need to get my jam back. It's, yeah. It's funny. It's, I mean, it's unconscious.
Yeah, I didn't take a break because, you know, I felt like it. I took a break because there was no option. And so that's scary. You know, it's not a good feeling, especially when you haven't, you know, felt that before. Like, you don't. I mean, it's easy to say now after the fact. It's like, oh, yeah, if you just sit for a while, you'll be fine. You don't know that in the moment. If I hadn't had, you know, a liquid, you know, electrolyte replacement, I think I would have been in a, you know, I think I would have sat there for a day or so because, you know, you can't just reload your sodium on foods.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. For me, in you know, the little experience I have is when I first was participating in these events, I wasn't carrying enough electrolyte. And then that's when I experienced the problems you're having where I'm pushing my bike up a hill and like, why am I pushing my bike up this hill? This is crazy. It's like you have no power. There's no power in your system. Mm-hmm. And it feels like every pedal stroke it's just like you're in, am I in my lowest gear? What is going on? Is it sandy? Do I have a flat tire? It's just very, it's
are
weird.
Are my brakes rubbing?
Are my brakes rubbing? Yeah. It's just a very weird feeling. And then, so what I started doing is I started carrying two things that I think really, really helped me personally. And I'm a fat guy. So not fat guy, I'm a fat adapted guy. So I eat a lot of fats. And the only time I'll usually eat a carbohydrate is if I hit a resupply and then, you know, I'll get some carbs in there, but generally I'm eating fats. And regardless of what you're putting in your body, you have to balance out those electrolytes. So I found that one for me is I always carry a couple hundred milliliters of maple syrup for the carbohydrate and for the potassium. And then I actually just carry a pouch of salt and I dip my finger in the salt. And what it went, the way I feel it is a bit of power. And then I feel it in my legs. I'll start to cramp. And I'll just wet my finger, dip it in the salt, and then just put it under my tongue. And you can almost feel it. You can almost feel the salt enter your system. So I can appreciate that sodium depletion.
And that's that salt trick. I used to work with Bill Vaughn, the guy who invented the power bar and then went on to do goo. So kind of invented the category of energy gels. So I worked with him directly. And, you know, for my races back in the day, he would mix me, you know, custom, you know, goo formulations. And that's what I would race on. And that was one trick that he told me was to always carry rock salt. Mm. And then when you just start to have those stomach troubles, like you can't digest, you just put some rock salt under your tongue. Mm-hmm. Amazing what a difference it can do to your stomach.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. And then I'd get to the point where and I'm a noon tab guy. I really enjoy noon tabs just for that flavor and the fizz and the, and I would even put some, and I usually just carry not rock salt, but like kosher salt, like coarse, non-iodized, like salt. Mm-hmm. And some people said, oh, you put that in your mouth, but it's different. If you put iodized salt in your mouth, it's like it's so acrid and
terrible.
Yeah. But if you put a little bit of kosher salt, it's almost like a salty lozenge. You just kind of let that dissolve.
Yeah, it's a little sweeter. It's palatable.
Yeah. And I'd even put a couple pinches of that in my bottle with a noon tab just to add, like, bump up the sodium.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't lose attention to that, to the electrolytes. I even heard a story. I can't remember who the guy was, but he was doing an ultra marathon, like a run, a 100-mile run with no calories. And all he did it with was he had a pouch of custom mix electrolytes. So it had like potassium, magnesium, zinc, sodium. And then he would basically dip a finger in that and just to replete his minerals. And I'm not sure the results of that, but I think it was slower than he usually would have done it. But he was totally able to do it on just his body fat alone. And just by
replacing. He took in zero calorie.
No calories. He was a fat adapted dude, and he was just bringing in, just replacing his electrolytes. I'll have to look that up to see who that dude is. I heard that on, I think it was the Human Performance Outliers podcast, Zach Bitter and Sean Baker. Zach Bitter, he won the 100-mile indoor, or not won it. He set a world record for the 100-mile indoor. Marathon, ultra marathon. So this dude, he's like the entire podcast is really, really focused on keto and carnivore and, you know, low carb and very, very high fat. And so yeah, look that guy up. I don't know what the pouch was. He said it was not very palatable, but
seems like a long ways. I've actually, you know, thought something similar. I thought a very cool, you know, event. And, you know, by event, maybe it's just, you know, me doing it by myself or, you know, maybe something broader. You know, pick a distance, say 100 miles through, you know, some pretty good wilderness. And, you know, start to finish, you have to live off the land.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, I mean, you can make use of anything you find. If you want to carry a fishing line, you could fish, you know, a bow, you could theoretically hunt, but you know, cross, you know, 100 or 200 miles of terrain without bringing, with starting with zero food on your own.
Do you hunt?
I did when I was a kid. Yeah. I haven't as an adult, but I grew up that way.
I heard a story and I don't know if they were, what side of the border they were on, but some guys went out on a big trip and they brought very, very little food just to kind of get them started, but they brought a bow and arrow and they brought a fishing rod. And they were able to basically live off the land as they traversed the terrain. And it sounded really cool. I'm not a hunter or a fisher, but
I'd be surprised if somebody could make it 100 miles only on their body fat. I'm
so
fascinated.
Yeah, we should. I wish I had more information about that. Who it was? I should have looked it up before the podcast. But you know, when you think of glycogen stored in our body, our liver stores glycogen and our liver shares that with the body. Glycogen that's stored in muscle tissue is strictly for muscle function. So I've heard that your liver can store something like 120 or 150 grams of carbohydrate.
About 3000 calories of glycogen.
Right. Right. So even, I mean, you're a fit, fairly slender guy. You might be what 10, I don't know. I'm totally guessing 10% body fat or whatever. So,
hey, that's fat.
Is that fat? Fatty? No, but
I'm down around 5 these days.
Oh yeah. But even that, even at 5% body fat, you're still carrying, you know, you got 3000. Yeah. You've got like literally hundreds of thousands of calories of energy stored in fat. So the importance of being, fat adapted, enabling your body to like, oh, I need some carbohydrate, and you can take carbs in without your body fighting that, and then be able to flip the switch and then start burning fat at certain endurance levels, I think is really important. And that's what I found really beneficial for me is that, I'm carrying cheese, I'm carrying not jerky, but salami, super high fat, and I'm carrying nuts, and then I've got the carbs in the maple syrup. I might bring some candy for palate fatigue, but I really find that especially at those endurance levels where you're not, you know, your heart rate's maybe 120, 130, man, on fats, you can go all day and not even eat. Like, I'll look at my food bags and be like, I don't need to eat. I don't need to. Might pop a couple almonds or walnuts.
Well, one thing that I noticed, you know, being older, your max and your active heart rate, you know, goes down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so now, you know, 20 years after, you know, doing one of these, you know, my active heart rate was probably 20 beats a minute lower. And I felt like it was much easier for me to process food because my caloric demands were lower because mm-hmm. my heart rate was lower, even though, I mean, it's hard to compare outputs. Like, you know, I'd say, you know, I'm not nearly as fast as I was back then. So my output is also, you know, lower, but even trying to account for that, I think that I, you know, eat less at the, you know, roughly the same output. And so that's easier to digest. So the whole eating thing, like I remember like when I did the Tour Divide, I was just on the edge of bonking the entire way. Because you're going so hard and you're trying to for so long and you're taking in so many calories that it was really challenging. And I think, you know, with this, it's like, you know, I've being older is in some ways a slight advantage in that one area. There are plenty of disadvantages, but in the area of caloric intake versus output, I think you gain a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, you could be right. Yeah, I think you could be right. I think also with age and experience and a little bit of wisdom, you tend to pay attention more to what's going on with your body as well. I think as we get older too, I think we're a bit more mentally flat. We're not so ego driven, you mm-hmm. know, as we are when we're younger. I think the level of suffering, I think, has increased. Because we're older and we've lived through so much shit that's way worse than riding a bike through the mountains, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's just like, I'm just riding a bike. Yeah, I'm bonking, but whatever. I'll just keep moving forward. It's kind of that, I mean, grit is the word for it probably, right? I think older people just have a bit more grit. But yeah, the caloric thing, I just assume that I'm constantly going to be in a major caloric deficit all the time. So I just assume that. I assume I know I'm not eating the amount of calories I probably need during the day. And over, you know, the longest thing I've done is like kind of a 5-day thing. And it's like, you know, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to finish at the end and I'm going to be thinner because my body's just going to be eating itself. Maybe that's unhealthy, especially for something like the Tour Divide. That must be something you really have to pay attention to because it's not just a 4-5 day event. It's like a 3-week event. Or mm-hmm. depending on who you are, 2 weeks, you know, so those calories, you have to probably really strategize. How are you going to intake? Do you have a caloric intake strategy? Like, are you counting calories or are you eating at certain times during the day?
Well, you're almost constantly eating. And it's, you know, it's like the Mike Tyson, you know, quote, everybody has a plan. You know, until you get out there. And it's really easy to have a nutritional plan, but then you hit a gas station and, you know, you've got to buy, you know, $100 or 100 miles worth of food. And sometimes, like, gas stations are way better these days than they were 20 years ago. Night and day difference. Like, you can buy 10 flavors of, you know, Clif bars. I'm not a big fan of those kind of bars. They're kind of hard to eat after, you know, a day or two.
Agreed.
But you have that option. And, you know, whereas back in the day, like I remember having to eat those Hostess pies.
Horrible.
It was that or a chocolate bar. And, you know, chocolate bars are good sometimes, but they're hard to eat when it's 90 degrees out.
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of get tired of them after you've had 10. And so you need a change of pace. So like you said, with cheese, I'm a big fan of string cheese because gas stations have it.
Yeah.
It's convenient. You know, it's wrapped and it, you know, it keeps reasonably well. And then it's a good change of pace from you know, some of the more acidic foods, because your mouth can, you know, start to get sore. Yeah. One thing that I do to help with the mouth issues is, you know, I grab, you know, a little thing of travel mouthwash, if I can, you know, find it out on the road. And that really helps keep your mouth in order. Because at times, like the long distance multi-day, you know, bike packing things, the thing that hurts most on me is my mouth, just from constantly chewing and eating and trying to process. So you want to keep that as healthy as possible. And I think it helps to mix in the you know, more base balanced foods, you know, with the acidic, so you can keep that going.
Yeah, you finally get the sores, right? Like, it's just like your mouth is full of tiny little canker sores, and then it makes eating really unpleasurable, and then you end up eating less, and then you end up getting into a deep caloric deficit. And yeah, there's so many things to consider.
Mouthwash really takes care of those sores. Mm. It prevents them.
Can you splash that on the undercarriage as well for those kind of sores, or what do you think?
Yeah, no, that's I would carry a tiny bit thing of astringent, and then I would, you know, dry clean, you know, the private areas. And I think that works super well.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, hopefully I'm going to do the Tour Divide next year, and I know there's so many things that I need to consider for longer efforts like that, like much longer efforts, because it's kind of quote unquote easy to kind of go out and push your limits for a couple of days, knowing that, you know, in 2 or 3 days you're going to hit a hotel room bed and you'll be done and you can have a shower and be done with it. But to sleep in the dirt for 2 or 3 weeks straight, and then having to manage, you know, calories and your personal health, your personal care, right? Your undercarriage, like your mouth. That's a really, really good point. You know, you got to stay on that stuff. You know,
when I did the Tour Divide, my sponsor at the time sent me some new bib shorts, you know, right before. And they were like the same ones that I'd been using, you know, all year. So they fit me perfectly. Couldn't have been happier. Never, you know, had a saddle sore. Never even really had friction, I don't think, in any of the 24 hours events I'd done. But they made a running change to the chamois and didn't say anything.
Oh, no.
So I'm out there, and like day two or three, I'm like, my rear end is on fire. And it's like, my butt doesn't hurt. Like, that's, you know, when you're training at that level, that's just not, at least on me, you know, thankfully, I don't have problems, you know, in that area. And so I kept trying to figure out what it was. And, you know, I tightened up my, you know, bibs and tried different things. And then finally I just took them off and I started looking at it. And there's like a thin layer of plastic, you know, in the middle of the, you know, chamois. So I had to cut that out. And then, to alleviate that, I had to start stopping at motels for a couple of hours just to soak my butt in water. You know, to, cause I had, you know, diaper rash stuff, but that wasn't working. So soaking in water is, you know, the fastest cure, even though, you know, when you're racing, sitting in a tub for an hour is not fast, but you know, you got to be able to sit down
It's the gains too. Like you have to equate the gains of stopping for an hour and resting and doing this certain thing, and then extrapolate that forward in that you'll have to stop less.
Right. Like, but keeping your contact points happy is so vital for your, you know, mental health too. And, you know, I think that equates to speed greatly. I've been listening to this neuroscientist, Andrew Huberman, and he has had some fantastic information on dopamine. And he cited this one study that looked at, like, what happens when you grind to a halt, like what makes your body, you know, stop. And they factored out things like, you know, muscle glycogen, you know, and fatigue issues. And so they found, like, the norepinephrine is secreted by these glia cells. And at a certain point, like they shut that off. And so there's no nerve impulse to go to your muscles, your body shuts down. But what they found is, if you get a spike or surge of dopamine, it turns that system back on again. So you can neurochemically you know, fire your muscles. So it's not energy, it's a neurotransmitter can literally make you go faster. And so I find, you know, that I've always, you know, blurred the line between what is mental and what is physical. But this really, you know, it brings them both together. And if you can keep your brain stimulated, it has a direct effect on your muscle strength and endurance.
Yeah, you have to be entertained. You know, when I hear people, I don't know if you're a headphone guy or not, but I always have buds in. I always, it's a book or music. So I'm more plugged in than not. And I just find that if I'll unplug for a little bit, especially if you start getting that you get to those points where you have these epiphanies and you need to think about something. You know, one of the reasons why I think a lot of people really love doing these events is because they're a stepping outside the box. They're kind of like a dumbing everything down to the basics. You think less. But what I find too is that things will almost in a meditative way, they'll bubble up. You'll get these thoughts or these epiphanies or these realizations about yourself or think the way you've been in the past, or for me anyway. And I find that when those come up, I'll unplug and I'll process that. And sometimes they can be, for me, they can be very painful. Painful thoughts will come up that like in a meditative thing. But I think I plug in more often to silence them, to silence those thoughts. And, but I agree with the dopamine thing. I think you need to constantly be changing, you need to be entertaining yourself in some way or another, whether it's with the landscape you're going through. You know, you can unplug and just like let the awe overcome you in an environment you're in.
For sure. And music is good, you know, dopamine release. You know, when you hear that song that you kind of get that rush of emotion because the song really resonates with you, like that's dopamine, and that has a very positive effect.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So just another platter on the scale of balance that you have to deal with, right? So do you listen to stuff when you're out there, or?
Oh, and the other, so I do. I go back and forth too. I usually only listen to, well, in the past I would only plug into music, you know, rarely because we didn't have the technology. Like I remember I literally carried a Walkman, you know, with one cassette tape.
I was going to say with a big case of cassettes shoved on the rack.
No, one
the back.
Cassette. Like, no, I can only take one cassette. So got to choose well. And then, you know, the iPod, I guess when I was running, the iPod mini was really good because you can hold a lot of music on that tiny little thing. But now with a, you know, your iPhone and a, you know, and a battery pack, you know, you can listen to a lot. And I think that's a huge advantage to, you know, both racing and just the experience of, you know, bikepacking these days is, you know, when you get either run down, you know, tired or mentally out of it, if you put on a, you know, a good song that resonates with you, that picks you up. Like that, you know, you get moving. I mean, I think that's at very least a very fun benefit. You know, you can change the pace.
And now depending on the mount you have, you can actually have your iPhone mounted up front and you could probably watch a movie if you wanted to now. We're so soft, John, now. We're so soft. Not like when you did the Tour Divide with basically nothing, right?
That's right, gosh darn it. Back in my day,
get off my lawn.
We didn't have GPSs.
Oh, yeah. I
on paper and we're mad about it.
Yeah. The paper maps, man. I just, that just blows me away. And you know, it's actually something that's on the back of my mind a lot when you're out there, because we rely so much on our electronics. Right. And if you know, we always have, like, I carry an eTrex 30X and then I have my phone as backup, ride with GPS with all the maps on it as a backup. And phones are so reliable, like really, like an iPhone or a Samsung, whatever you carry, they're such a reliable device now.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to lose/break/ have a malfunction in those things, that could be pretty devastating. You know, if you don't have any other navigational method, it could be pretty devastating.
Oh, and I found that out. So, you know, I'm new, you know, to, you know, all of this. So I got my first, you know, cycling GPS unit this past winter. I got a Wahoo Roam, which I absolutely love. I mean, it improves my bikepacking experience 100-fold compared to, you know, staring at a map and wondering which unmarked dirt road I'm supposed to go down. You just follow the dotted line. But I had problems with it. It started crashing on me. And it kept, like, all year long, it has been perfect, not a single issue. And then as soon as I started, it kept putting me about 50 yards, you know, off of where I was. Which sometimes, if you're on a road, might not be a problem. But if you're in a network of single-track trails, 50 yards is a huge problem. So that was, you know, kind of aggravating. And I thought, you know, like, this is the one piece of redundant gear I didn't really, you know, take. I mean, I had my phone with, you know, Ride with GPS on it. But you can't really navigate with that because it burns through batteries so fast.
Oh, yeah. It's only as backup. Yeah.
You've got like 2 hours of battery and then you're toast. It's not functional. I'd ended up, like, as soon as I got out of on the east side of the mountains and into less cover, my GPS worked perfectly again. But it's definitely something where I would think, you know, I definitely want to have it's worth carrying 2 ounces of backup when that's your whole world is your navigation.
Yeah. I've been carrying that. I've had that Garmin eTrex for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years now. Never failed me. Never, ever failed me. And it, on the last race I did here in the Kootenays, that was, how long was that? 2 days and almost 3 days. I didn't have to change two AA batteries for the entire, the entire event. So yeah, it sucks that I know a lot of people are leaning into the USB rechargeable devices. But you're not the first person I've heard that have had problems with non-Garmin devices. I think Garmin's been around for so long, and I know they're not the most intuitive interface. But out of all the bikepacking gear that I've purchased, that eTrex is the best money I've ever spent because it's never failed me. And the one thing I would say, two things, not intuitive. It's really hard to navigate around, which is why the backup's really nice. Because if you get into a place where you need more granularity, you can like pull your phone out. You can zoom into something, you know, for a few minutes and not burn your phone battery out. And the other thing with the eTrex, there's that. And then there's the, I lost my train of thought. Damn it. There was two things. Can't remember what that other thing was.
But there's the other, detail. So I mean, there's a case you can make, you know, either way. With the Roam, the usability is so easy. I see a lot of, you know, people complaining about they can't get their route loaded on, you know, any of the Garmin devices. But, you know, once you do, they work perfectly. Whereas with the Wahoo, it's so fast and easy to get your route on there, and you know it's there, and you just go. So
yeah.
I think that'll, you know, it'll work itself out. But again, like, those problems are, you know, pleasant compared to, like, the Tour Divide. I probably had a pound of paper maps. Like, all 10 of them? Like, I never weighed it, but, like, they must weigh a half a pound or a pound, and then they take up a ton of space.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, other, you know, pieces of gear, Ortlieb sent me some bikepacking bags, which were just flawless.
Awesome.
Just perfectly made, totally waterproof. Didn't have to mess with it. You know, I just installed them, loaded up my gear, and I was set. And that's kind of what I want in terms of, you know, low maintenance, durable, very well designed gear. And that's, you know, back in the day, we didn't really have that.
Yeah, there's a lot of choices now, for sure. I always try to send people to kind of small mom and pop shop manufacturers, because I think there's a real boom there happening with, you know, Thief bike packing and Rogue Panda and Oveja Negra. Like, there's so many great bag manufacturers now. I did want to rewind just quickly. So we talked at length about fueling. It's like, what specifically did you start the race with for food?
Well, it's interesting. One thing that I started doing new this year is baking cookies.
Oh, yeah.
Because I thought, I was just looking at options of, you know, what to eat when I ride. And I just thought, you know, it seems like it'd be better having a little bit more control over the process, at least when I can. And I thought, you know, I should just at least start with like the best food possible. So I made cookies and I double the butter. So they're a little bit more calorically dense, and then they, you know, they hold together really well. And they go down, they're not as dry, you know, they're moisture with the butter. So for the whole first day, you know, I carried homemade cookies. And I thought, one, it's good just to have your first day nutrition super dialed in. So you start consistently and with everything that you know. You know, control as many variables as you can. And then after that, you're up to the mercy of whatever gas station you hit. But I thought, I'm going to control the first day. And I am so happy with that. Like those, I do kind of a peanut butter oatmeal cookie with extra butter. And I've never been happier in terms of my fuel.
There's that dopamine.
I would do them the whole way if I could, but you know, you can't always find cookies.
Yeah, that's a dopamine hit, right? Just you eat one of your homemade cookies and you're like, nah, it just feels good, right?
Exactly.
Real food. I think the homemade real food thing, yeah. What else did you carry? Some electrolytes, goos? Yeah, you said some goos in there too?
No, it's too, carbohydrates are, you know, it's a little bit too heavy to carry. And it's just not practical. So when you're carrying your own food, you have to go a little bit more towards the high fat. So I started with nothing but cookies. And then, you know, I had my electrolyte, you know, drink that I would, you know, mix into water bottles. Stopping at a gas station, I would get either Gatorade or I found this stuff, Body Armor. This is nice because it's cane sugar.
Okay.
Instead of high fructose corn syrup. Mm. The only odd thing about it is it has almost, you know, we're talking gas station, you know, options here. It has almost no sodium.
Mm.
I think it's 70 milligrams in a big 28-ounce bottle. So you have to, you know, add your own sodium. And I don't know why a commercial product that's kind of trying to compete with a Gatorade and, you know, touts its electrolytes and its natural ingredients, why would it have no sodium? I don't understand their logic there, but if you add sodium to it, it's a lesser of evils of gas station nutrition.
Yeah, for sure. You can use it as like a base and then add all your good stuff to it. I always try to steer people away from Gatorade.
You don't have an option out in the
rural. Yeah, I think I'd rather just drink water than drink Gatorade and get your electrolytes either through just the raw sodium or adding an electrolyte tablet or those.
But so you can only carry so many tablets because, you know, like I love, you know, Noon.
Yeah.
You know, you can't carry, you know, 5 pounds of Noon to start a multi-day ride. So.
No, and they're probably hard to find. You need to call ahead to all the gas stations and find out which ones, if any, carry Noon. Because, I had 4 tubes and then on the last race I did. And then another guy had scratched and he said, here, you love Noon, take my Noon tabs. So, and then some of them have caffeine in them. So they're kind of a nice, don't bring a stove or anything. So it's a nice little hit of caffeine in the morning, a caffeinated Noon tab. I always find
that. Yeah. I try and avoid caffeine, when I'm racing.
Oh, you do, huh? What's your logic behind that?
If you do too much caffeine, you can, you know, get your brain scrambled a little bit. Like when people have hallucinations and issues like that, it's partly caffeine driven.
Oh, interesting.
And then also, like I found, like I just don't, I think it would amp me up a little bit too much. Mm. I get, you know, and you know, there's two sides of the coin as to whether or not it, you know, improves fat burning versus is it a little bit of a diuretic? You know, you can, as long as you're doing the same amount of caffeine that your system is used to on a daily basis, it won't be a diuretic. But yeah, I'm cautious with it, I guess I'd say.
The diuretic nature is, that's a good point. Like, I certainly try not to over caffeinate. I think I did that with, on an event once with those 5-hour energies. I don't know if it's caffeine in that or taurine or there's some stimulant in that, but I was doubling down on those, just trying to get ahead of the way I was feeling. It was a mistake. It was such a mistake. I think if you can stay as close to your circadian rhythm as possible, you know, even if you are skipping sleep with the way you feed and add compounds like caffeine or carbohydrate, mm-hmm. if you can stay as close to your normal, natural, everyday circadian rhythm, I think your body adapts better. As soon as you hit a gas station and this has happened to me as well, using it as a reward, it's like, oh, nice gas station. And you're eating chips and chocolate milk and just like, it's this mental thing. It's hard to control. When you go in, you see all these foods and your brain or your gut brain, your second brain, is just screaming out for certain things that you know that I can't have that because that's going to destroy my digestive tract. I think it's important.
It's funny you mentioned the circadian rhythms. I've become a very big, believer in that because of, what I've seen. And I first noticed it back in 1992. I did a race across Australia. So it's kind of a crazy adventure, but, the second half of it, myself and two other guys were riding together, kind of, race across America style, like nonstop, as many hours a day as we could. And so we're doing a three-man, pace line on dirt, 20-some hours a day for multiple days. So you get a really good feeling for who's strong, when. Mm. And it changes. And it doesn't just change, but it's consistent.
Interesting.
Between the three of us. Like, each of us had a time of day where we were stronger than the other two, and each of us had a time where we were the weakest, of the three. And it was, the same time every day. And that really stuck with me. And for me, mine is, it's late afternoon, like around 4 or 5 p.m. And I've even noticed it in training. I'm just significantly stronger in that, time window of like from 5 to, dark or, 10 or something. So I've tried to, pay attention to that when I, and then also charting my heart rate when I sleep. It between 4 and 6 is always when my heart rate is the lowest. So if I'm in a situation where I have the option to sleep, I try and cover that window because that's, the hardest, if I try and ride through the night, that's my hardest section is like right before, dawn. Cause my natural tendency for my body is that's my lowest point of a 24 hour clock.
Yeah. It's interesting. circadian rhythm thing, I have a Whoop strap. So I've been using that to kind of track my physiology. And I notice the same thing with sleep is you go to bed and your heart rate just is on the steady decline throughout the night. And it always seems that you sleep deepest 2-3 hours before you kind of wake up. You get in that mm-hmm. slow wave sleep. And it's interesting. I can relate to that a little bit. I find I'm really good in the morning for the first little bit. And then there's kind of that mid-afternoon, which I think everyone feels anyway. Even if you're sitting at work, you get that mid-afternoon, like, man, you're kind of flat and you're just like, bah, your mood changes and you just take a break. And then I find like around that dinner time area, into the dark, like I love just riding into the dark. I usually have great energy. Mm-hmm. And then once you hit midnight, I think your body starts going on automatic and it's like, okay, it's dark, it's cold, and that cold makes you sleepy. Your body temperature starts to go down and you start to kind of get sleepy and it's super interesting. And probably with those guys you were riding with, were they Australians that you were riding with?
Yeah. One Australian, the other guy was American.
That was interesting. Cause you guys would be on different, time zones too, right? Like, I wonder if that had an effect as well.
Oh, I totally messed up. Like the first week of that race, I would wake up every hour and a half with bed sweats, one, but then, wake up every couple hours because your whole system is just completely out of whack. It was really challenging.
Did you have to go there early to acclimatize your rhythms to or were you just there 2 days before the race and you
got there 2 days before? Yeah. I didn't have the option to get there. Like, in hindsight, I would have, I've raced in Europe a couple of times, doing long distance running races. Yeah. It's really hard. You can make a case you should get there a week before, but then you kind of have crappy sleep for a week.
yeah,
you know, leading up to it. So I think I could make a case kind of like altitude, either get there a few weeks before or get there right before, so you don't have a sleep debt built up.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're also physiologically different. Everyone has their own strengths and weaknesses. It's so funny. And on this last race, I decided I wasn't sure if I was going to not sleep the first night, because oftentimes I'll just not even maintain a rhythm, and just like, I'll just ride through the night, and then maybe 3 a.m, if I'm tired, I'll lay down and then get up 2 hours later and keep going. And I found this time, by keeping that rhythm, like riding till, you know, maybe do 18, 20 hours of movement, and then, you know, at midnight laying down for at least 4 hours and sleeping, I found that my next day energy was a lot more consistent than if I were to just like ride through the night and not sleep that much. Like I did the similar race last year, and I only slept maybe 5 or 6 hours on that one. And this time I think I slept six, seven, 8 hours over the course of the whole thing. But I was overall, I think, faster, even though the course was slightly different. It was same distance and relatively the same amount of climbing. I was actually a bit faster. And it could be my fitness level at the time or whatever, but I've changed my angle on the sleep. I think, especially for something like the Tour Divide, I think I would try to maintain some sort of circadian rhythm with riding till midnight, sleep till 4 or 5, you know, get up, go again, and then just, you know, keep that, because your body, you need to recover. If you're not recovering, you're just going to completely deplete yourself over time.
Yeah, but the other thing I think with the difference in technology, I think I could do the Tour Divide again on a lot less sleep than I did the first time I did it, because of the GPSs.
Go way like further.
I had sleep more when I did it, because you have to have your brain together.
Right.
When you're trying to navigate at 3 a.m. in the dark, you can't be, there's a certain amount of fatigue where you're going to do more harm than good. Because if you can't figure out navigational, you know, issues, you're going to lose a ton of time. Whereas if you're just following a dotted line, like that's pretty brain dead. Like you can do that, you know, and be squirrely. Whereas you can't do that if you have to, you know, kind of figure out the logistics of a map and, you know, really orient yourself. So I think that's, I guess what I'm saying is you can push yourself harder with the technology, because you don't have to be as, you know, kind of aware and coherent.
Yeah. Less stopping for sure. The stops would be shorter. Because that's the one thing I love about having the unit, the GPS unit, is just, I call it flicking the nipple, right? It's just like you'll pass a crossroad and you'll just flick the nipple and be like, nope, we're good. Just kind of keep going, you know. But I found that you do have to pay attention, because the worst is to just fly by a fork and forget to check your GPS and then start going downhill. That almost happened to me a couple times in this last race. But I discovered it beforehand. But you still have to be aware. Like you still have to be quite alert.
You do. You have to be aware that, I think the advantage is not that it doesn't prevent you from getting lost at all. But once you do miss a turn, you'll find out sooner.
Way quicker.
You know, and then you can know, you know, you got to turn around and go back. So you get back on course faster. But, you know, I missed turns for sure. This, you know, last thing I did.
So 1 or 2 weeks ago, I think Bonnie Gagnon put something out. Pose the question if there should be maybe not a category in the Tour Divide, but what would people think about doing it old school? Maybe doing it with no cell phones. And I don't know if she was going to the paper map idea or just a GPS, but no cell phone. I can't remember the exact post, but it was basically dumbing it way down, like removing the technology as much as possible from the race. What do you think about that? Would you be interested in attempting something like that again with, I mean, you've been there, done that. You've already done that. But
that's the difference. And I was, you know, it would be, it's so much easier and more emotionally pleasant with the technology. Like it's a security blanket.
Yeah.
Like, I know, you know, a lot of people, you know, carry, you know, like Garmin inReaches, you know, the those, and I didn't, you know, on this one, I just didn't, I didn't really think about it. I had one and I, you know, I didn't bother really taking it. Because I feel so connected with the technology that we do have, you know, between a cell phone and your GPS, you're super connected. I do think it is different when you do it in the old school way. You're more self-reliant. Like even, you know, with, you know, me, you know, falling apart, you know, on this ride, there is nothing more rewarding than having that type of situation and extracting yourself from it. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had had a, you know, inReach, you know, I certainly wouldn't have, you know, hit the panic button. But I think like maybe most people would have at least thought about it or would have contemplated it. But I didn't miss it. And I like that self-empowerment of, you make decisions differently also, you know, when you don't have that crutch of, you know, calling in the cavalry.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, it sounds ignorant to argue against technology. I mean, it adds a level of safety. And if you really got into a pinch, you know, I'd hit that button, you know, just as quickly as anybody else would. So I think it's a smart thing to make use of. But in terms of doing it with no maps, I think it would be kind of charming and, you know, a more earthy, you know, encompassing experience for someone who hasn't done that, you know, before, and just go off on your own and kind of, you know, take in, you know, everything. But I mean, I did that for 20 years, so.
I'm over that. No, I'm over that.
Yeah. Good. You know, I loved it. I really do like the Luddite simplicity, you know, of that era. And now I embrace the luxuries of technology.
Yeah, it's a good point you made about it being a psychological crutch, right? Having, knowing that people are watching you, basically. If you were on a tracker using a spot or an inReach and you're tracking your progress, people can see your progress. And I think it just gives peace of mind. I mean, for me, I have a family, so it's important that they at least see that I'm moving and that I'm still right out there. It helps a lot, I think. But it's interesting because, yeah, when you look at your rig and you see that little electronic unit there that's basically sending your position, it's kind of like, no, I'm good. And you could be in the middle of nowhere, you know, where if everything failed, you'd be fucked. You know what I mean? You're just in the middle of nowhere. And so it's definitely, I appreciate the crutch, but I feel the same way about the technology. There's no question that technology has made the times faster. And that's not just electronic technology either. That's right down to wheel size, to, you know, gear choice, the lightness of bikes, you know, like all this technology we kind of take for granted. Like we're not riding, you know, 40-pound steel bikes anymore. Like some of these bikes are just state-of-the-art, you know, rigs where if you can save 10 pound on a rig build, you know, that technology alone, that's huge. That's going to make you faster, right? So technology is not just in electronics. I think it's everything we do.
Yeah. I was super happy with my bike. I've got a Salsa Cutthroat. Mm.
And you have mustache bars on that too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a nice setup.
I really like that setup. I think the biggest advantage, you know, compared to back in the day is the tubeless tires.
For sure. Yeah.
You know, and like running a big tubeless tire, you know, soft is very plush. You know, I rode rigid, you know, at least on that route, I wouldn't even consider, you know, any suspension. And that was more, that, you know, I would say the Cross Washington, I wouldn't call it a gravel route. You know, it's not a technical mountain bike route, but it's, you know, you want a bigger tire for some of the surfaces. You don't have an advantage with skinny tires.
Yeah. I think you're just exposing yourself to more issue, you know, like I'm a big fan of fast rolling, fatter tires. Like I was running an Icon race, you know, it's a lot like
a lot like the what's the other one I'm thinking of? Anyway, it's just like low chevron height, you know, just like a block tread pattern. Really spicy when it gets dusty and loose. And hi, Sloan. My daughter's waving. Thanks, honey.
Yeah, I rode Continental Race Kings because they on right. You know, bicyclerollingresistance.com, which is a great website.
Oh, nice.
They're about the fastest tire out there. And it was a 2.2, which was overkill. Like, if I'd had a choice, I would have ridden a, you know, 50 or, you know, 2.0. But you can't argue that they've got lower rolling resistance than, like, I mean, than some road tires. It's crazy how fast they roll.
Yeah, it's interesting too that, you know, like, I don't know. I think I lean more towards a larger diameter tire, just because that's your contact surface. And, you know, I wouldn't call it a sacrifice, but yeah, to go to a 2-inch tire or like a 50, and then you get into some chunder, you know, and then you have to back off. I think I'd just rather have the rubber underneath me, a low rolling rubber, you know. I've always leaned that way. I don't know what I would do for the Tour Divide. I don't know what I would run on that. Whether I'd want to, because I know people who've, it's the Chronicle is what I was thinking about before. I was running a 27 plus with a 3-inch Chronicle on it, which is way too much tire, but the rolling resistance of that tire is super low. But when it got spicy and a bit technical, you could push that tire a little bit. You know, and not have to worry too much. It never really held me back. Where I think if I went with a much narrower tire, I feel like it would hold me back a little bit. I don't know if you agree with that. It would depend on the route, right? Obviously that you're riding on. But
yeah, it totally depends. Like even, you know, what you call a gravel, you know, a gravel road, like a real gravel road with, you know, like chunks of, you know, rock in the gravel.
That shot you posted, yeah, the double track with the, it looks like river rock. Looked like.
Yeah, that's kind of extreme, but and actually these tires were a dream on that. Like, you know, that section looks like it you'd kind of be sinking or floating in it, and these Race Kings just it was like it was paved. I didn't even nice. Notice it. But in or even, you know, like loose gravel, and it can be a graded road, but sometimes a bigger tire is way faster than a smaller one. Like I remember there was back in the day, there was a Wilderness 101 race in Pennsylvania. There was a combination of gravel roads and then, you know, kind of sections of real single track, rocky Pennsylvania single track. And so it was always, you know, some people wanted to ride like almost road tires because you could, you know, on the gravel. And I think I went with I rode a mountain bike and a 2.0 tire, kind of the same I did on the Tour Divide, you know, just a fast rolling 2-inch tire. And you know, they roll fast enough on smooth gravel. And then, you know, you've got a little bit of, you know, plushness, you know, when it, you know, gets dicier. But it's, you know, finding that balance between weight and rolling resistance. And
yeah, you're always compromising, I think, like, because especially on some of the tracks around here, it's like, you know, you're in the Rockies and it might be gravel, but then it'll peter out to a double track and then nothing and then grass. And then it could be just chunder and baby heads. And I always feel like you have to pick the tire for the, almost for the lowest common denominator trail you're going to encounter mm-hmm. so that you're at least ready for that, you know, for safety. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, people could debate tires like for hours, right? So going back to the Cross Washington, how did you feel? Like, so when you decided that you were going to pull the pin and scratch, how did that make you feel?
In some ways, just the answer was so obvious to me that, you know, it wasn't, I mean, I was disappointed, but it's not like I was devastated just because I was very, you know, pragmatic about it. You know, it just didn't look like it was going to work out. I don't like, you know, cutting anything short, but, you know, sometimes that's you can like it or not like it, but it's just the way it is. Mm. So the quicker you accept it, you know, the quicker you can move on and, you know, go do, you know, something else. You know, I guess it's a luxurious position to be in that I've had plenty of success. So it's, I don't see it as a, you know, a reflection, you know, on myself, you know, I don't have to, you know, take that. It's more, and I think, you know, I did long distance trail running for a few years and, you know, that taught me to be a little bit more, you know, humble about things, you know, too. And with running, like biking is easier in some ways because you can always shift to a slower, lower gear and just ride slower. If you're having an off day, you can just, you know, go slower. But when it comes to trail running, you can't do that. And, you know, I just learned that sometimes it's just not your day and you're better off just, you know, instead of running yourself completely into the ground, maybe it's better to just stop and try it again next time. You know, life is short, but there's next year, next week or whatever it is.
And I think it's always valuable to set. And I'm sure when you went in, like, did you go in with a set of expectations? Like, were you mindful to, you know, when you first got on the trail and you left, you had kind of a base level of expectations that you were hoping to meet, and were one of those expectations, I'm not going to use that word failure, but scratching or quitting, like was that kind of in the realm of possibility when you started?
I tried to keep as open of a mind as I possibly could. Another thing, you know, in regard to dopamine, that's fascinating. There's this thing called dopamine reward prediction error. So if you go into something with a set of expectations and you don't meet those expectations, your secretion of dopamine is physically less. Mm-hmm. And so I tried not to have too lofty of goals because I didn't want to, you know, have the letdown of not meeting those goals. But you always do in some way. So I'd say for the first half, I did the first half of the race in 1 day, 21 hours, I think, which was far greater than my expectation. I did not think I, you know, was capable of doing it that fast with that, you know, moderate effort level. So in that way, you know, I far exceeded my expectations. And I think it gave me the confidence, you know, now being able to ride, you know, the first 40 hours without, you know, pushing myself. If you do it once, you know, you can do it again. So, you know, I could go into a project and feel a little bit more confident in some ways. I do have to get the sodium thing figured out. You know, and maybe that's as simple as, you know, just increasing my sodium from the start, whether it's hot out or not. Just start at a higher, you know, sodium intake. And maybe my older body, for whatever reason, just needs that. You know, I don't know.
I love how you use the word project before just then, a couple sentences back, because it's interesting. We always call them races. I try not to call them races because, you know, it's very individualized. Right. So it's who you're racing. You're kind of racing yourself. You're kind of racing your expectations. You're pushing your limits and you set these goals and expectations and hope to reach them. I like the idea of calling it a project because it is a project. You know, there's planning involved. There's, you know, food planning, nutrition, hydration, entertainment, self-care, butt care. You know, it's like you have to be your own project manager before you go into one of these events.
Right. And I guess I did, you know, when I started, I said, put on Facebook, you know, I'm headed out for a walkabout. Yeah. And, you know, I really meant that. Like my, you know, I was going out for an adventure and I didn't know what to expect just because of the time, you know, gap between, you know, doing projects. I thought it was entirely plausible that I'd hit 3 a.m. on the first night and, you know, like my legs would just turn off or something, you know, I would just, you know, be fatigued, or my knees wouldn't be able to take the stress, or any, you know, of a number of things, you know, could have happened just because of the fear of the unknown. You just don't know how your body's going to do. So I guess I was, you know, very pleasantly surprised that despite being older, I don't feel that much different. You know, I'm a little bit slower than I was. You know, I'm not doing it full time and I'm 55 years old, but in terms of, you know, how I felt riding a bike, I felt the same as I always have. It was that, and that was, you know, that was a great feeling to have, just being, you know, back on the bike and, you know, pedaling easy after 37, you know, or some hours, and having fun, you know, just like just having fun, you know, despite riding through the night was a really, for me, a great feeling.
It's good medicine. Riding bikes, it's good medicine, right?
Absolutely.
I think that's why we all do it. You know, like I was telling someone the other day, actually I was leaving for a ride the other day, and you know, I just put our kids down and I went in to say goodbye to Jasper again, just like, hey buddy, I'm just going for a ride. And he's like, no, don't go. And I was thinking, as one day you'll understand. One day you'll understand. Yeah. It's not that I need to get away from you. I need to get away from life. Like, you just need to kind of unplug and dumb it down and just ride a bike. It makes me feel like a kid, right? When you're riding a bike, I think it's really important.
Yeah. And I think the other nice thing about, you know, the adventure was, I didn't think about this. It didn't occur to me until afterwards, but I went those, whatever it was, 4.5 days and, you know, 550 miles. I don't think I said a word to more than maybe 4 people, you know, total. And that was, you know, for me, I'm kind of a, you know, introverted, you know, guy who likes the outdoors. That was me being in my element. I really enjoyed that.
I've said this before too. I never feel more like myself than when I'm out on the trail alone. Mm-hmm. Like, it's that concept of no mind. It's just like you put all the other stuff aside, all the, like I've said this a number of times too. It's like this ego dissolution when you're out there. It's just, you know, you're so insignificant, you know, you're so small. The scale of things is so awesome because you're in nature, in the mountains and the big skies and big rivers. And it's just like, you're just nothing. Wildlife, mm-hmm. You know, that you're in their territory, you know, and you're visiting this other place that you don't get to go very often. And it puts you on a different, I don't know, it's not anxiety, but it just tunes you in. You're just tuned in a different way to things than you are when you're, you know, at home with the family or sitting at your desk at work. Or it's just this wonderful escape to just shut things down and just be yourself for a few days and reconnect.
It's a fascinating mix of being totally tuned out to the, you know, this, especially 2020, you know, this crazy world. You're totally crazy. Tuned out of that, but then completely tuned into yourself. The only thing that exists is your little world and what you see in front of you. And I liked that, the mix of those two things and just focusing. And then like you can look at this and, you know, that distance and say, you know, that's like, you know, an endurance test, or, you know, some people say, you know, these things are, or people who are drawn to these things are, you know, a tiny bit masochistic. And I feel the opposite. Like I just had, I had fun. It was a, you know, total enjoyment.
Yeah. I think people who say that they'd have to do it to understand. It's like, you're crazy. You're masochistic. You're, and it's like, well, yeah, you know, but for people who like to, even during the week, during their regular home life, who like to go out for 1 or 2 hours and pin it on their bike. You know, we do that all the time. You know, we're constantly dealing. It's just smaller chunks of these events, right? You're just doing it in smaller chunks.
But I feel the same way. It's just, it's fun. It's got ups and downs, right? Sometimes you're just like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, why am I doing this? I miss my shower, or I miss my bed, or I miss this or that. But, you know, you walk the 300 yards to the top of that climb, and you knew in your head, man, if I could just get there, you know that it's going to switch. You know that there's going to be a switch in your head. You're going to take a deep breath and just be like, ah, all right, at least for the next hour, I can cruise, you know, relax, recover. So it's a constant roller coaster, right? And just being out of your element, I think being out of your comfort zone, being uncomfortable, I think is important, because we're so comfortable now with things. It's good to be uncomfortable. Maybe have crappy sleeps on bridge decks in the woods under the stars. It's like, why not? Like, you know, the bed will be there when you get back. Everything's going to be there when you get back. And then, you know, when you get back, you're going to miss the trail. You're going to miss the road, and you're going to miss sleeping under the stars. So,
yeah. And just speaking of sleeping, like when I bivvied, you know, that second night, I just had the most luxurious spot. It was, you know, under a pine tree. So a bed of pine needles. Like I don't carry a, you know, sleeping pad. I have a little 2-ounce pillow, and I put that under my hips. That's one thing I've noticed differently with me in old age. When I was younger, I could sleep on a pile of rocks and wake up and take off and feel fine. And now I can't do that. Like if I sleep on something too hard, I wake up and I can, you know, I can't touch my toes. My back is totally out of whack.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
The one, you know, piece of kind of old age, you know, comforts of home that I've had to bring is just that little inflatable pillow, but that's all I need. And that works perfectly. I couldn't have been happier than, you know, at home in bed. I've got a nice little 1 pound down sleeping bag. That's super cozy. I love that too.
Yeah. It's amazing how little you need to really be comfortable, and then, and learning how to multi-purpose all your stuff too. Right. Like, well, I'm not going to bring this, but I do have that. So if this happens, I could use that, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's again, part of that project, right? Just breaking things down into must haves and don't needs, just to make it as simple as possible.
Yeah. And I think with my gear selection, I probably went conservatively, just because, you know, I don't have as much confidence because I haven't done anything and I wasn't sure how my body would respond. You know, I thought, you know, if I have, you know, start to, you know, have issues, I might want to, you know, be able to extract myself from my situation. So if anything, I packed a little bit heavy, but still my kit was half the weight of what I took on the Tour Divide.
Yeah, no doubt.
So it's, you know, it's just when you've decreased it that much, if when you're in doubt, it's like, do I carry one inner tube or two? Like so even though I ran tubeless, I carried two tubes, you know, just in case. You don't want to be walking 20 miles.
And you pack your fears, right? I did the same thing. I was like one tube or two on this route. And I was thinking, nah, it's mountainous. We're in the mountains, you know. And I was running narrower tires than I was used to. I was running, you know, the last couple races I did with a plus tire. And then this was like a 235, which is still fat. Right. But it was like, well, I brought two tubes. So why not? It doesn't weigh that much. And it gives you a little bit of peace of mind. I didn't flat at all. Obviously that's the beauty of tubeless, right? Is flatting is fairly almost, it's almost removed the problem really. As long as you pick your lines wisely, then you can avoid slicing a sidewall. But, yeah, it really just makes you rethink. So now that you've had this experience, are you already planning your next?
Oh, for sure. Just depending on kind of logistics and that, I think I'll do a snow race this winter. I'll either do Jay Peterberry's Fat Pursuit.
I'd love to get
down
or
for I'll
that.
Go to Alaska and do the to McGrath race. I haven't decided. I don't think I have the time and resources to do both, but I should do one. And then I am signed up for next year's Dirty Kansas XL.
Nice.
I'm kind of assuming I'll do that. And then I'll probably do the, you know, Washington, cross Washington again. I, you know, finish that one out.
Redemption. Got to finish that one. Now you know more about what to expect, I guess, of that route and of, expect of yourself. You know, now you've noticed your body's changed, right? So it's like, oh shit, what I used to do doesn't work anymore. I got to do this other stuff now. It's interesting.
Yeah. So I'll have, but I'll have a lot more confidence in how hard I can push myself. So I think that will be an asset.
Right. Well, biggest lesson learned on this last one?
Lesson learned. I think the lesson I learned is age is not a barrier. I think, you know, I am for just only riding a year after a huge break, I'm pretty flabbergasted at how fit I am. I thought it would take, you know, a lot longer if, you know, never to kind of get to my current, you know, fitness level. So that's encouraging. Like, you know, age, you know, just because you're 55 doesn't mean you can't go out and do cool rides. Like, it's not a limiting factor at all. Might not be quite as fast as you were when you were younger, but, you know, who cares about that? Just go out and have fun.
That's a good answer. That's a good answer. Because it's true. It's like, I think, I can't speak for women. I know for men, it seems like we enter our peak physiology when we're in our 40s, it seems. Like, I feel like my 40s, I'm 50 next year, but this last decade has been flabbergasted. I'm just like, wow, it's crazy. Like, I'm not 20 anymore, but I can still go out and ride with 20 somethings. Yeah, they might be a little bit faster, a little bit ballsier. Definitely not as ballsy as I used to be. Got to pay a mortgage now. But it's like, it's interesting how the fitness level is. You don't tend to lose it. And it doesn't take as long to get it back. Maybe you found, like, you know, for you just training for a year and you notice, oh, I can go out and do this. I can still do it. So that's encouraging for people who are sitting on the fence or who say they're, oh, I'm too old to get into that or whatever. It's like, you're never too old to do stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just got to get out there and do it.
Absolutely.
Right on. Well, John, thanks for your time today and congratulations on your, I know you didn't finish it, but it's still an eye-opening experience, an experience nonetheless. And, I hope we can chat again soon.
Sounds good. I'd love to, Steve, and awesome. Really appreciate you having me on. It's an honor.
Oh, it's an honor's mine, John. Seriously. But, I appreciate it. So, where can people find you online? Are you Facebook guy or are you,
Instagram? I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I need to get on there more. I don't do much with it. I can tell by my age, I'm more Facebook demographic, but, either place.
What do you think about the whole social networking thing?
For me, it's great because I have a lot of acquaintances from, you know, from traveling in the racing world. And it's nice for me to know, you know, and they're kind of spread out all over the planet. So it's nice to see friends doing cool adventures, you know, in, you know, different places. And I can kind of, you know, stay in contact with them. So I selfishly, I love it. It lets me see folks that I wouldn't normally get a glimpse of.
I don't think that's selfish. I can appreciate that as well. I've definitely taken a step back on the social networking thing. I don't know if you've seen Social Dilemma on.
Yeah.
Man, if people who are listening to this haven't listened or watched that documentary yet, it's worth a listen. But I think it's important to stay focused on the positive. And if you're going to put yourself out there on social networking, keep it positive, keep it encouraging, keep it inspirational. And I think that you've done that. So,
Like this ride was kind of cool to be able to, you know, go out and do an adventure and have it share it, you know, real time, you know, through Facebook was kind of fun. And like people were super encouraging and it was just nice to know that people cared and they're out there and, you know, they're kind of following along. I thought that's the first time I've ever done anything like that. And that was really fun.
Yeah. It's great. And it's great that it's just shrunk our globe down so much, you know, and it's allowed us to connect in this way, you know, and I consider you a good acquaintance of mine now. And it's, you know, it's only because of social networking and the great community of bikepackers that are on that network. You know, they make it awesome. And yeah, so I think it's encouraging for everyone who's wanting to get into it. So if people want to reach out to you with any questions, they can do that on Facebook if they feel up to it.
Absolutely. Awesome. More than happy.
Right on. Well, thanks again for your time, and we'll chat again soon. Okay.
Sounds good.
Right on. Yep. Have a good rest of the day.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, good chat. You ever going to do the Tour Divide again?
I'm pretty sure I will. I would, I might wait until I'm 60.
Yeah, there you go.
And try and do a good 60, you know, plus age mark. I mean, it's a huge time commitment.
Yeah, it really is.
So it's not like you can just, oh yeah, I'm, you know, do that every summer. It's like, no, it's kind of a big deal. But I for sure, there's almost no way that I won't do it again. It's just, do I do it in another year or two, or do I wait until I'm 60 and try and do, you know, do it well one more time and just kind of see the, you know, difference in 25 years or however long it's been.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I really want to do it on my 50th year, just as kind of a, like a milestone or a benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think people think about age in a negative way, and they
right.
like we talked about earlier, just like it's gonna detract from their fitness, and it doesn't have to. And yeah, I should have asked that question before, but I'll edit that in to make sure. But good to know that it's still on your radar.
Yeah, for sure. And it's fun to see how popular it is, you know, these days. Like, the Tour Divide's kind of a big deal. And yeah, people come out, and I'm sure, you know, the folks who race it, they probably get people cheering them on, you know, in various locations. And that's just great to have the community along the trip embrace it. I think that part is really fun.
Yeah, I think that's the thing I'm looking forward to most, is just, you know, one, just getting out, pushing it, and having that adventure, but then also just experiencing that community, you know, and experiencing the trail magic and the trail angels that are down the route, and the encouragements, and just, yeah.
If those places can stay in business, because I guess the Pie Place in Pie Town, you know, went under, and there's got to be, you know, a dozen places just like that.
Yeah, it's super
unfortunate. Rely on summer tourist travel, and they don't get that this year. They can't survive that.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can spread some dollars down there and get them to reopen. Maybe. Who knows? Who knows what will happen? Maybe they'll set up a pie table.
Yeah. But then the other side of the Tour Divide is there's so many cool events out there now. It's like, do I do something I've already done, or do I try and go do something, you know, totally different? Like, I don't know. There's lots of them.
Yeah, it's true. And then there's the Wild West route as well. I think they're discouraging people from racing that. They want to keep that kind of more of a touring thing, because I don't think they want to see the volume on that route, which I can appreciate. But yeah, it seems people come back every year to race the Tour Divide. So there's got to be some magic in that that's drawing people back. So yeah, I'm looking forward to experiencing that for myself. But yeah. All right, John. Yep. I don't want to take up any more of your time. Thanks so much. And we'll chat again soon. Okay.
Sounds good.
All right.
Have a good,
you too. Take care. I want to thank John again for his time, and thank all of you for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed that informative conversation, man. It's crazy. You know, when you think you're out there sometimes on these races and you think you're suffering, but you know, at least you're still moving and you're not bonking and you're not starving or you're not like shitting your pants or whatever. Can have so many things can go wrong in these events, and it's you know, it's unfortunate that he had the experience he had, you know, and he couldn't have wrapped it up. But it just puts things in perspective, I think, when you think you're really it could be so much worse sometimes, right? It could be so much worse. So I hope we can use this as inspiration, especially the kind of age angle. It's like, you know, a lot of people think they can't, you know, ride these distances, whether they're racing or just touring or whatever, just getting out there in the woods and doing it. But age isn't a barrier, you know. The only thing holding you back is fear, and you can overcome that and get out there and do these things. And they're life-changing journeys, and I would encourage everyone to try to tackle a route or a race like this sometime, and on their bike, and just see how it works out for them. I want to thank you for tuning in again. Please send me voice intros, myback40podcast@gmail.com. Again, just whip out your device, record me something in voice memo in a voice memo application and email it off to that address. I'd love to add it to the beginning of the show. I think that's really all I have. Had a great ride today. Had a great fat bike ride. It was super fun. No snow down here. It's all gone. It was good to be on the dirt regardless. Good to get some miles on that fat bike before the snow flies. And I hope you're getting out there as well and getting your wiggles out and clearing the mind, riding with no thought, just enjoying that peaceful time in the woods. And don't take it for granted. Get out there and do it. Love you guys. Take it easy. And we'll see you next week. Keep the rubber side down.